thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 107, recorded October 2nd, 2014, an Easter basket of hugs.
Well, hello again, and welcome to yet another edition of Digital Campus. Here, coming to you from the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. I'm Mills Kelly. I am not in the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media at the moment. Instead, I'm in the beautiful and slowly collapsing Robinson Hall, which is where the History Department is located. And I wish I were joking about the collapse. Let's see. With us today are some of our regulars, Dan Cohen. Dan, are you in the greater Boston area or somewhere else?
I am. Google Maps tells me I'm currently 358 miles from the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media.
In a secure and undisclosed location?
Right, just somewhere in that radius.
So. Okay, all right. So we can find you if we need to.
Yeah.
Stephen Robertson, the director of the center. Stephen, are you in the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media?
I am, and in fact, I think I have been for every podcast. I boringly have not tried to do this from a more adventurous location. So as usual, I am in my office.
Oh, you're going to have to get out more. Going to have to get out more. Also joining us today from the center is Sharon Leon. Sharon, are you in the center or are you elsewhere?
I am in the center. I'm at the other end of the center from Stephen, so I'm down the other end of the hall.
Sort of waving distance, perhaps, but,
yes.
But maybe not a good sight line.
Not exactly.
Also with us today are our two production folks, some fantastic graduate students in the history department, Amanda Regan and Stephanie Seals. Thanks, guys, for helping today. And so today we're going to begin our podcast with a follow-up to a story we didn't get to the last time we were on, and that has to do with yet another controversy about what people say online and how that in what academics say online and how that affects their job situation. Dan, you want to pick this one up for us?
Yeah, well, I just think all of us realized after we got off the line last time on the podcast that we were talking about the, I guess, the decline of Twitter or some worries in 2014 about the state of Twitter. And of course, didn't mention at all that there had been a professor who was offered a tenure job at the University of Illinois, Stephen Salida, that I'm sure a lot of people have heard about, who in fact had that offer rescinded. I believe he was at Virginia Tech and then had been offered a senior position at U of I, and sort of over the summer had tweeted about the situation in Israel and Gaza, and was promptly terminated by the president. Or actually, I think what happened was, or is it the chancellor, did not advance his candidacy to the board, which is generally a sort of pro forma step. Look, there's so many angles on this, we probably could spend several podcasts on it, and there's quite a lot to step in, I suppose, if we want to talk about it. And certainly one of the odd things about it is this weird sort of pro forma approval of tenure that can go awry in this way that I think a lot of professors didn't realize. Certainly those who change universities don't realize that a lot of it is contingent upon something that happens after they've already left their old university. And so they're in a bit of limbo, and certainly there's been stuff written about that. But to focus, Mills, on what you said, you know, I think the main factor here was what is certainly, I think, now an understandable concern about one's online behavior, as if Twitter wasn't already problematic enough from a lot of the things that we discussed last time and some of the negativity that's gone on. I think certainly a concern about tweeting and what, in this case, just a handful of tweets led to certainly adds another layer of trouble. And I wonder how it's going to affect sort of online discourse going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that was, you know, kind of troubling about that is it became a discussion about civility as a kind of governing principle, and obviously in ways that sort of clashed with some basic notions of academic freedom. But there does seem to be, you know, and maybe this does dovetail with the conversation we had last week, this kind of new language of civility being applied to some of the online conversations. And I think a lot of the follow-up rhetoric that was interesting about this case was arguments made that you know, the tone of the tweets somehow reflected the tone that the professor would employ in the classroom, and that therefore the what you and how you express yourself on Twitter is a measure of how you would express yourself in any other forum, which I think most of us would agree is a kind of logic that most people wouldn't accept. Whatever you think of the way that people express themselves on Twitter, the notion that it has a seamless connection to the way that you express yourself in other settings seems to me to be a kind of disturbing sort of logic. But certainly, you know, what you could say about civility on Twitter becoming seamless with what you could say about this thing called civility in other contexts, I think it's a disturbing kind of sort of both language and inability to recognize that people can have different personas in different places.
Yeah, I think that point about personas is a good one, and I think particularly in media where things tend to be a little bit more off the cuff, you can drift into informality and different kinds of tones. I mean, obviously, this is I think the particular subject matter obviously is a huge part of this, but I think in general that sort of super ego check on one's tone, and particularly about questions around civility, again, I think will probably give a lot of professors understandable hesitance when working in a medium that I think everyone on this podcast has wanted to use more, not less. So it does cause some problems.
Yeah, I mean, I get that, and I agree generally. But at the same time, I think that taking the perspective just for a second, playing devil's advocate, if I'm a potential employer who doesn't know you except from a couple of interviews that we had, you know, I know your body of work, but I don't know you, and so I think it's often really difficult for employers to judge what someone's, you know, where the boundary is between, like, I like to be a little snarky on Twitter as opposed to I'm snarky all the time. And so it does, it's that boundary, I guess, is really the key, is the possibility of misperception is so great when somebody, you know, that's all they know is what they can read. It's kind of like, you know, about 150 years ago when I first started working in a job where I had to make a lot of phone calls, and my boss at the time said to me, you know, you need to smile when you're talking to people on the phone. This was a sales job. He said, you need to smile when you talk to people on the phone because they will hear that smile. Otherwise, they have to project how you're responding to what they have to say. And so you want to make sure that they get it. And when it was on the phone, it was much harder because people really had to sort of fill in the emotional content from a fairly dry conversation. Online, text and images and videos and other things that we might post, it's a lot easier for people to make their own interpretations, and that's really hazardous because they're going to make their own interpretations. And so, you know, it's a conversation we've had before, you know, when we were talking about whether faculty members should use Facebook or what you should say, you know, as a blogger when we first got started on the podcast. And it really is your whatever online persona you create is what people are going to think you are. And there, you know, Stephen, you said it, or you implied it wasn't really fair for people to make that kind of judgment. But I would respond that I don't know how they can make any other judgment. You know, they get what they get, and they have to do the best with it that they can. And if you are really snarky on Twitter or in your blog or wherever you're posting stuff, they're going to think that you're a snarky person.
Yeah, though I guess in this case, you know, this is a job candidate, so they right. had a body of evidence about it. You know, the classroom one I think particularly bothers me because they had a body of evidence about Stephen Zaleta's cast room performance that directly contradicted the kinds of interpretations of what he did in a classroom that they chose to make on the basis of a handful of tweets. And so, you know, his teaching evaluations and all of the things that we know we gather that say that directly addressed the kinds of concerns about him as a teacher that the tweets might have raised, and the tweets, you know, a handful of tweets were effectively given weight well beyond that kind of evidence. So I think, you know, I'm absolutely not suggesting that people, you know, should somehow tweet without, in a sense, that people can take it drastically out of context. But I think we might have expected a little bit better of an institution that had gone through a hiring process and had more evidence on hand about this candidate than the handful of tweets to
right, and I wasn't
make assumptions about that.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about the specifics. I was talking about the sort of the general. Yeah. I don't, you know, I'm not really qualified to say what the specifics were in that case, but just sort of in general, this is certainly not the first time that we've talked about someone, you know, in the however many years we've been doing the podcast now, that it's not the first time that we've talked about somebody having some employment difficulty because of things that they posted online. And so just in, I was taking more the general position.
And I agree. I mean, and that's certainly the warning that everybody takes from this yet again. But I do think that we are reaching a point where it's reasonable to maybe ask for a little bit more nuance in thinking about that, you know, that there's now, you know, the days in which it was just a blog or just a Facebook page that you had to worry about. Now there's multiple outlets for social media that, you know, that exist because different things can be done on them. And I think it's, you know, perhaps time to tilt that back the other way. But certainly this case suggests that, you know, that the dangers of all of those things remain in a really pronounced way, in a way that is going to continue to perhaps retard academics' willingness to step into these platforms in more meaningful ways. And, you know, my optimism that there should be better is certainly not borne out by this case, but I think it seems to be a little out of step with the extent to which we're engaged in a broad spectrum of social media now.
Yeah, I would agree, but I would also say that it's worth remembering that while in the digital humanities we're immersed in this world, the vast majority of people still don't use Twitter, pay no attention to it, and don't understand it or how it functions. And so, and I would cite as evidence of that, you know, an organization which should be a little more sophisticated about these things and isn't, and that's our local professional football team here in the Washington area, which posted some sort of, you know, they're in the middle of a controversy about the name of the team and whether it's racist or not. And the their PR people, who should know, posted something encouraging fans of the team to show their support on Twitter, and they put up a hashtag for it. Well, of course, what happened instead was all the people who are very upset about the name of the team posted, you know, thousands and thousands of tweets against the team, and they had to like shut down for a little while to make that stop, because these are PR people who should know. And so if PR people are making these kinds of mistakes, it's no surprise to me that other people really misunderstand how these kinds of social media work. And so it is that then raises the point, Stephen, that you're making, which is that you know, and Dan also, that it can create a kind of chill on the kind of conversations that we value in these online spaces. So, you know, this is not the last time we're going to talk about such things, and that's for sure. Other news that we're tracking for the podcast is some recent conversations about the future of learning management systems. And anybody who's read my blog or listened to me rant about them knows that I'm not a fan in general of learning management systems, no particular vendor implicated. I just don't like them myself, but for a whole variety of reasons that I won't bore everybody with. But Stephen, you were the one who brought this up as a topic. You want to tell us why you think this new sort of evaluation and looking at the future is going to be interesting?
Well, I mean, I was just struck by but a report that came out recently from the Educause Centre for Analysis and Research on kind of the current state of learning management systems out there. And I, you know, let me preface this by saying that I'm by no means a fan of learning management systems. But certainly the report confirms the kind of here to stay aspect of this, you know, claiming that 99% of higher education institutions have a learning management system of some sort in use. And part of what the report sort of is challenging is the notion that most academics don't like learning management systems, and they found much higher levels of approval than I would have expected in many ways. But I think that there's a sort of a bit of a sting in the tail of that, because the survey showed overwhelmingly that these systems are being used essentially simply to deliver syllabi, to deliver content to students, and nothing else. And as they add more and more features to learning management systems, people just simply aren't using them as they go forward. And so at a level of satisfaction, as a way to put a syllabus in the hands of your students, I would probably say that a learning management system, if it's been foisted on me, did that effectively. But I think the claims for them are certainly much broader than that, and I don't know that the kind of support that this survey shows for those basic functions endorses them further going forward. I think the other thing that's kind of interesting lurking in this study is a sense that students actually don't know how to use these systems, and that whatever kinds of digital literacy they're now bringing to campus, that doesn't seem to include a capacity to navigate the learning management systems that the institutions themselves are using. And I think in some ways that also pushes back against the kind of notion for what these systems, you know, are supposed to be able to offer. Now, and the EduCourse report's kind of implied solution to this is that institutions should perhaps be looking at offering their students training opportunities in learning management systems. But I'd have to say that if I had to take a stab at it, I would assume that part of the student's struggle is with the actually completely non-intuitive design of most of the learning management systems that they've actually got in their hands, and that the training is probably, you know, in some ways not really the issue. The issue is the continuing problems that these systems offer in terms of actually a straightforward way for anybody at either end, the academics at the back end or the students at the front end to use them. So it's an interesting report, and you know, I mean, it certainly confirms that we're not getting away from these things, that there's a plethora of platforms out there. Even as Blackboard continues to buy up competitors hand over fist, there's still more out there and a growing number of open source platforms out there, but also a lot of institutional mobility between platforms, which is probably not going to help either the student or academics making use of these things. But it just you know, to go back to the last point I made, it's that fundamental sense that nobody really wants to grapple with the fact that they're just not very good interfaces for everybody, and therefore they're being, in the language of this report, underutilized by faculty. And I guess the other part of the underutilization argument that I think is interestingly buried in the details of the report is that they're surveying students on the kinds of things they would like learning management systems to do that they're not doing. And in fact, a number of the systems do offer the things that the students would like them to offer already, but they're not being utilised by faculty who don't sort of get beyond the content use stage. So, you know, these are clearly here to stay, but we don't really seem to be at a point yet where we're really grappling with ways in which to actually make them more useful, more intuitive. And I don't think that the notion that they're being adopted by faculty is really a particularly powerful argument to me when, you know, they're still using only the most basic functions that were there right at the beginning. And so, you know, this world of learning management systems that we're putting our students and faculty in, I think is, you know, in the broader conversations that we're having about what's possible in digital environments, I think still a drag on those things. If this is what people encounter as their first encounter with the digital, then it's certainly not going to encourage them to explore all of the you know, much more interesting and interactive and dynamic things that are out there, because they remain so limited.
Sharon, do you use a learning management system?
I use WordPress. I use WordPress, and I use only WordPress, and my students are incredibly frustrated with the fact that I use WordPress instead of what we have here is Blackboard, I guess. And the primary frustration is they want at any second to be able to look at their grade in the course.
Which
they
is one thing WordPress absolutely will do for them.
It's the one thing WordPress will not do for them, and they want to be able to monitor their grade by not monitoring themselves, by not monitoring their attendance, their, you know, their work on assignments, their engagement with the class. They just want to be able to look at the number. And so I'm actually happier that it's hard for them to make that kind of assessment about where they are in the course, because it requires them to think about what they're actually doing. My concern about all of this is that as we get more and more push from institutions to do or to think about fully online delivery of courses. I think their tendency to suggest that this should happen through a less than stellar learning management system because the infrastructure is already there endangers all of the things that we think about that are useful about constructivist pedagogy. And so I think we're going to start to have to fight this on this battle on many, many fronts. I just saw something yesterday about a consortium of Big Ten schools in the Midwest that are banding together to do online courses, and they're going to use Canvas as their platform, their delivery platform. And I don't know whether Canvas is better than Blackboard or not, but the notion that institutions of that size are going to get together and make that decision and then start to do broad spectrum delivery of courses kind of scares me.
Well, Canvas is at least open source.
It is. Yes.
So if you look, there's this Inside Higher Ed has a nice story about this. It came out on the 23rd, kind of summarizing some of what we've been talking about. And one of the links in that story is to an EDUCAUSE page about the Next Generation Digital Learning Environment Initiative from EDUCAUSE, and their support for this from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And so I just read the first sentence of the abstract because I think it really cuts to the heart of the matter, and that is that in the abstract, are tools that support teaching and learning keeping up with leading business and consumer tools? What would a next generation digital learning environment look like? Well, so I'm actually interested in this question of whether the learning management systems keep up with business and consumer tools, because I Gates should have just given me the money, because I have a really concise answer to that, and it's no. So and so, you know, give me the money and I'll answer the question and we're done. And the reason is because, going off into the world of employment, our students, whatever their academic program, will be required by their employment to use various digital tools in various ways to accomplish the objectives of whatever their employment environment is. You know, in the healthcare field, you know, nurses and physicians walk around now with either, you know, really big phones or small tablets, and they're looking at your medical records and making decisions based on what they see there. So my wife is a realtor, and she had to learn GoToMeeting the other day because she's working through some new contract thing with an over 55 community, and they have training that she had to go through, and she had to sort of muscle her way through GoToMeeting, which she'd never used before. And the first time out, it's the bar is kind of high to figure out how to make it work on your laptop. So that, you know, people have to do this. What they will never do when they graduate from a university is use a learning management system again. They will never use Blackboard unless they become a cashier in the University Food Service, which uses Blackboard as its cash point system. They will never use a learning management system again. And one of the reasons is that those learning management systems are sort of bounded environments that only focus on delivering course content in the way that the designers think it should be delivered, not in any way connected to how employers are using digital tools to help their employees accomplish the goals of whatever their work is. And so that's why, more than anything else, I don't use learning management systems. Is I want my students, like Sharon, I use WordPress and other kinds of online tools, and I want them to learn how to use a whole bunch of different stuff and try to figure out how to make that stuff work for them. And I think that's a lot more valuable than a learning management tool. So if you're listening, folks from the Gates Foundation, stop giving money to EDUCAUSE to fund the research on this. I've answered the question. You should just write me a check and send it. I think, Stephen, you're right, though, that these are here to stay. The question that interests me in the here to stay part of it is the one that the Inside Higher Ed story discusses a little bit, and that is about the degree to which these tools will be open source or not. And I think the more open source they are, the more faculty members are going to find them interesting and generative in various ways. And so you know, we'll see. Dan, at the Digital Public Library of America, do you use Blackboard or any similar system?
No, we don't.
Yeah, I'll take the laughter.
We try to use as many mods.
I think your staff uses digital tools. You are, after all, the digital public library of America.
Yes,
right?
We do. We do. Yeah. We use all your standard tools. We're heavy Slack users, which we found great for conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we have the flexibility of being new and being able to do these things. And we don't have these silly accountability requirements for just a small, nimble nonprofit. So it's tough. I mean, I think, as with a lot of, you know, large bureaucratic or institutional software solutions, these things are, you know, they're just there for, you know, somebody in the IT department made a decision they need an LMS and they go out and get one. And, you know, a lot of professors are, let's put it, a little bit lazier than all of you. And so don't want to be creative about cobbling together what are really, at the end of the day, very easy or, in fact, easier to use tools like WordPress. And so, you know, here we are stuck with these things. And there's a lot of lock-in. I mean, Mills, you mentioned, you know, Blackboard did something very savvy from a business sense, which is they bought point of sale company to incorporate in so that you have like Blackboard embedded in everything, not just your learning.
So I'm now going to qualify my snarkiness, and boy, I hope that snarkiness doesn't get me into trouble, like we were talking about a minute ago. But say that there is a very large cohort of our colleagues who teach one class at one institution, another class at another institution, and so for them, Blackboard and other similar kinds of, and we keep using Blackboard sort of as a shorthand because they have such a big position in the market, but these kinds of learning management systems, and to be able to go from institution to institution where they are trying to cobble together a career as educators and be able to use the same system in every place is a tremendous advantage for them. And so I don't want to minimize that, and I think that it would be really great to see these, and they're often the heaviest users of these kinds of systems because so often it's in the introductory courses that are so heavily taught by contingent faculty that learning management systems are the sort of the bedrock of how the course is delivered. And so, you know, some serious thinking by some of these big companies about how they can support contingent faculty who are some of the heaviest users of their product, I think would be really welcome.
Yeah, because I think the reality is that they're going to go from campus to campus and system to system. Based on these reports, you know, Blackboard share is big as it is, but it's all over the place. And I think that, again, you know, none of these systems make that transition any easier. And so I think that, you know, that continues to be the challenge. That none of these systems are particularly intuitive, and they're all over the place. I mean, the EDUCORE's report is suggesting that there's a lot of institutions are coming to a point where they're going to have to make new decisions about these systems. And so maybe, you know, it's a moment for, you know, they're suggesting in some ways that there's some potential change in this market poised to happen. And so maybe it will deliver something more like what you're suggesting, Mills, a greater degree of consistency across campuses that might at least make that experience more useful.
Yeah, or at least just simple interoperability.
Yep.
So, if I'm going from, if I'm an adjunct faculty member teaching, you know, one course at George Mason, another course at American University, and another course at GW, and all three of them have different LMSs, if I can't get all of my, and I might be teaching a version of the same class in all three places, if I can't move my course content easily between those three systems, that's putting a tremendous burden on somebody who's getting paid almost nothing, and so that's a real consequence for contingent faculty that you know we just don't talk about. And I mean the consequences of these LMSs, we talk about contingent faculty. So it's one of those things that I worry about. And something that I don't worry about is JSTOR. JSTOR is an important part of my life. I really like having access to JSTOR, and so I'm glad that there's a JSTOR. I wish everybody had the same access that I have, but it does make my life easier. Certainly, I get less exercise because I don't walk back and forth to the library as much as I used to. But nevertheless, I'm happy that there's a JSTOR. And JSTOR has hit the news again this week. Nice story by our friend and sometimes podcast contributor, Jen Howard, from the Chronicle of Higher Education, that she wrote yesterday, I guess, on a new online journal that offers daily dips into JSTOR's deep archive. Dan, you've taken a look at this daily dip phenomenon. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I like it. My summary is I like it. I have you know, advocated for a long time on my blog that there needs to be some experimentation in this kind of genre, which I guess is sort of translational work from academia to the general public. And I think some of the best of that work, which is sort of, you know, mid-form 1,000 to 3,000 word kinds of more for a popular audience kinds of writing, is happening now, actually, at places like The Atlantic Online, where there are, you know, very smart people, in fact, people who have PhDs, who are writing what really is, you know, historical work, political science work, work across the humanities, in the arts, architecture, and also using and taking advantage of the affordances of the web to include things like video and maps. And so I think there's just a great area out there for more work to be done that isn't just, you know, 6,000 to 8,000 word text essays. And so what JSTOR Daily, or maybe was it the Daily at JSTOR? I should probably get the name right. But what this new site does is it takes work that is in JSTOR, which is in that traditional academic form of the long footnoted item, and turns it into something that, again, approaches something that's sort of between a blog post and an article. And so I think that that development in general is good. I think the design of the site is terrific. I wouldn't be surprised, in fact, if it's WordPress. So all around, I'm positive about this. And I think that especially it looks like they're sort of inviting academics to make use of the site and to sort of propose topics and pieces for it. So I think done right, again, setting aside perhaps some other concerns about JSTOR that we might have in terms of access to the general public, I think it is done right. And I should note on that access point that all of the articles referenced in these pieces are, in fact, openly available, at least for the period that the piece runs on the Daily site.
Anybody else taking a look at this to see what they think?
Yeah, I love it. And I think that the thing that I like the best about it is that if things like this and the writing that's going on in The Atlantic and those sort of things can get a little bit of traction, we might, thankfully, at some point, get away from the tide of navel gazing about academia that absorbs so much of the writing that is done on the web by academics. And so to actually see people engage with content, about content, makes me really happy. And to have it be in the kind of prominent place that it is, to bridge the gap between the public and the academy, I think it's got a lot of promise.
Stephen, you were going to say?
Yeah, no, I kind of agree. I mean, I like, you know, we've got a lot of places out there where academics are trying to bridge, you know, the ground between their research and a popular audience interest in that. But, you know, this particular variation of that, where it's grounded in published scholarship, you know, that is then made available, as Dan said, for at least some period of time directly through JSTOR, I think is an, you know, it's a nice kind of blending of some of that open access concern and a pointing at the actual scholarship that humanities scholars produce, you know, so rather than just, you know, being positioned as experts, this is drawing off the actual output of people, and you know, I think that's a nice twist on this. I'll be interested to see how many academics write for this. I mean, their current writers are largely not academics. You know, they call them smart writers at some point in their blog. Smart
smarties,
yeah, people smart enough to make sense of what scholars do and be able to bit, but not write like scholars about it. So, but they're certainly inviting scholars to pitch. And I think it will be interesting to see, you know, what kind of scholarly community appears who wants to use this as a platform to cross that bridge in a different kind of way. It's probably worth noting in that regard that they are in fact paying people to write for them. The stories are, you know, they're appropriately cryptic about how much they're paying. It's clearly not a lot of money, but as we all know, academics are very rarely paid to write. And so in that sense, they're staking out a slightly different ground for themselves, again, assuming that they do in fact find academics who conform to what they want to write. But that kind of anchoring in scholarship and providing access to scholarship and reminding people that it's scholarship that makes, you know, academics experts, I think is a nice twist on this, bring, you know, trying to bridge out to a broader audience in terms of just making people aware of and giving them access to
actual scholarship to ground things behind it. So, you know, I think it's beyond to that bigger universe that Dan was talking about, but there are some interesting and I think potentially fruitful tweaks in the way that they're pursuing it that it'll be definitely worth following.
Yeah, you know, go ahead, Dan.
Oh, no, I just a gloss on that. I think, you know, Stephen was talking about some of the angles that they're taking. I think one of the really interesting and promising ones is, you know, perhaps they're not like right on the news cycle, but a few months later, they kind of revisit, like one of the stories they led with was revisiting an article on gender roles that was a cover story. It got a lot of, you know, discussion that was in the New York Times in the spring, and they kind of revisited it using, you know, interviews with academics and also looking at the actual articles that were used in the New York Times article that are in JSTOR, and really giving it its, you know, a much more careful read, the actual scholarship than the author of the New York Times article did. So I think that's very promising. I mean, obviously what academia offers is a kind of, you know, much more obsessive and in-depth look at things. And oftentimes when that shows up in a place like New York Times, which obviously does great scholarship and or great reporting and great journalism, but it's not scholarship, and the depth and the nuances of that scholarship are often lost. And so I think JSTOR Daily can come along and provide a lot of those nuances, and don't, you know, have the column length or word length restraints here on this site, so they can go into much greater depth.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, I'm with everybody on this, that I think one of the great potentials here is for opening up a conversation that is not an academic conversation, but is a serious conversation. You know, academic meaning appealing to a tiny little cadre of experts in a field, and a serious conversation, which is based in the kinds of things that we've been talking about, takes on, you know, interesting and important issues, but and has, you know, sort of a serious tone to it, while at the same time being lighter. So that I'm really interested in to see what kinds of things are going to appear. So I'm with you, Dan, and everybody else. I like it. The next topic we want to talk about is one that has we've come at in a variety of different ways over the last couple of years, and that is the sort of should everybody code question. And this is especially important to us in working in the digital humanities, because we wonder about this, not should everybody code, but should everybody in the digital humanities be able to code at least a little. Speaking of somebody who can write about four lines of code, I used to be able to program in BASIC. You know, I was pretty good with BASIC, and I could, I was a fiend at the DOS prompt, let me tell you. But speaking of somebody who's not much of a coder, and you know, I guess maybe I feel a little guilty about not being so codey anymore. But there's a story that we noticed in Wired magazine about yet another place for people to learn to code. You know, there's been Code Academy and others, but this one struck us as, you know, at least worth chatting about for a few minutes. And it's a the design is fun to see. It's exorcism, but not spelled the way it is in the dictionary, more like exercise, but exorcism.io. Created by a software developer rather than an academic, a woman named Katrina Owen, who also teaches coding. And she was worried that her students weren't completing the projects. And so she created this site as a way to pose problems to her students initially, and for them to get some crowdsourced mentorship on how to solve the problem, and did it in GitHub, which is a site that we all love. And or at least I think we all love. I'm speaking out of turn, maybe. But and what she found was that it didn't exactly go viral, but it got really popular, and that lots of people started chiming in, and students started finishing the assignments, and that sort of thing. And so it's, you know, we call attention to it because it's an interesting place to think about. But I think the bigger issue is that this question of, in the digital humanities, should we be teaching our students to code? Sharon, you teach a lot of grad students. Do you think we should be teaching our students to code? Like, should that be necessary?
I think it definitely depends on what it is that they want to do in their work. I mean, I don't think there's any way in which we can make a uniform pronouncement about those sorts of things. I'm like you, Mills. I, you know, I dabble around, I tinker. I couldn't build anything from the ground up, but I'm currently overseeing 3 software projects because I know enough to ask the people who actually know how to do this to do it. So I think that the question of what is the level of literacy that is necessary for your scholarship to move forward in an informed way is a question worth asking. And, you know, we have a bunch of graduate students here at George Mason who are learning all sorts of good things in the area of coding to do the work that they want to do. And but they're by no means the majority of those students. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's like learning a language. If you need the language to read your primary sources, you should learn it. But if you don't, you should spend your time in other productive ways.
Stephen, what do you think?
I mean, I tend to agree. Adding, you know, the almost uniform prerequisite here is that my coding ability is absolutely tinkering based. On a good day, and again, I've been involved in a major project in which there were a lot of people doing far more than tinkering. I don't think that even in the digital humanities, everybody needs to be able to do everything. You know, our concern with coding goes alongside our concern with collaboration. And, you know, I've collaborated with a lot of people who code and been involved in projects where being able to code is crucial. But being literate in what's going on in those conversations, I think, is the most important thing. And then I'd absolutely agree with Sharon. It's then about what you want to do, what you need to learn to do, as it would be with any kind of method, that it's about the questions and how you want to pursue them. And I do think it's thinking about what you know, I'm teaching the Clio 1-hour Introduction to History and New Media, which Stephanie is in at the moment. And, you know, I am struck sort of rebuilding that syllabus by the fact that, you know, there are now an increasing number of open source tools out there that make it possible for people to do a range of things that they would have had to learn coding to do before. And I think it is, you know, really worth our consideration that we make full use of the tools we've got before people then go and decide what else they need to do in terms of developing the ability to build those things or customize those things themselves. You know, those are important skills, but I think sometimes the call for everybody to be able to code can end up in a kind of everybody needs to you know, build a new wheel again, and we tend to overlook all of the work that's been done that now makes it possible to imagine projects that were once coding projects that are in fact projects using tools where the ability to customize rather than build from the ground up is the most important kind of coding skill.
So now we turn to Dan, who actually can code.
Yeah, last but not least, horribly. One coder in the room.
People have to realize how many times I crashed the H&M servers in the early years when I actually was coding. It was terrible.
That was you that was doing that? Okay.
Well, that and the fact that our fiber optic line into the van in the parking lot where CH&M was for a while kept getting cut. So.
Well, yeah, that was a problem. I remember those days.
Yeah, so I mean, I think Sharon and Stephen have put things quite well. I mean, the one thing I would say, which maybe is slight odds with them, is that I think it's important to at least understand the possibilities that are available when you at least have some sense of coding. I don't think you need to be a coder, but I think that being literate about what code is, and I think Sharon and Stephen would agree with me here, I think that understanding is... it is important, and it can lead to new tools and those sorts of things. So I'm a huge advocate for, as Sharon said, like you should do what's important for your work rather than emphasizing a specific thing, right? Like I'm not going to learn Akkadian because I'm not doing ancient Middle Eastern history. So it's not like that has some kind of just generalized purpose, although I'm sure it would be very interesting and I could learn a lot about grammar and those sorts of things. So in that way, but I think we probably all agree that, you know, you at least need to know what the medium can do and what code can do. And I think you can do that by looking under the hood a little bit. But whether you need to go through something like Exorcism, which sounds like a terrible Friday the 13th movie, is probably not the case, but But again, understanding the possibilities, that's what I would underline. And I think we've seen some very important tools emerge out of the Roy Rosenzweig Center because of that understanding. I mean, Zotero, for instance, was in part, you know, came out of the recognition of what the coding possibilities were within the web browser in the kind of later years of Mozilla and the early years of Firefox. And so I think just that understanding of what could be done in that environment then led to a kind of new tool. But obviously, I think ideally, in the long run, we'd want most scholars to kind of get away from the metal itself and into the more intellectual pursuits.
And speaking of Zotero, Dan, this will warm your heart. As you probably remember, I have a freshman in college this year. For our listeners at the University of Mary Washington, feel free to make his life difficult and be as often as you can. And but well after his dad's bedtime last night, I got a call and a text and a Skype message. Dad, can you show me how to use Zotero quick?
Excellent.
So that's a sign of sort of it's Zotero has finally made it, right? So when the 17-year-olds of the world are appealing to the old men for help with Zotero, I see that it's really a good thing. Sharon, we also wanted to turn to you for a little update on some things that are happening at the Rosenzweig Center. Can you fill us in?
I can. I have, speaking of software projects, we have a variety of very, I think, exciting things, either in process with Omeka or just beginning. It occurs to me that we haven't talked a lot in the world about the work that the Omeka team has been doing for the last 2 years. They've been working really, really hard in addition to keeping up with the day-to-day needs and development of the base software. They've been working on something called Omeka S. And Omeka S is funded by the Mellon Foundation. And the idea with Omeka S is that it would serve the needs of our larger institutional users. In the effort to build what is basically kind of a multi-site version of Omeka so that libraries and archives don't have to have lots of, you know, 10 or 15 siloed installations of Omeka, that they could put all of their material in a central database and use it in lots of different ways. That has resulted in a complete redesign of the information architecture and the data model for Omeka. So I think that some of the things that are coming out of that are going to be appealing to the world, the primary one is that it is all JSON-LD underneath. So that means for those of you who are not familiar with it, that Omeka S will be nicely fitted into the linked open data world. The other thing that I think folks will find appealing is that it will be possible to attach media to Omeka items in a variety of ways. Right now, really for an item to be meaningful in an Omeka installation, it needs to have a file attached to it. It has to have, you know, an image or a video or an MP3 or something like that. But then with Omeka S, it will be possible to continue to do that, to attach a file, or to point to an existing URI, to something that lives out there in the world, or to drop in an embed code. And what that does is that opens up the universe of things that can be used with Omeka quite considerably to material that might be in a Fedora repository, or material that might be on YouTube, or on Flickr, or any of those other things. And then any number of users can then use those items to build individual sites. So we're making great progress on that, and hope to have people testing in the world by the new year. But we also have had some really good news in the last probably 3 weeks, both coming from the Institute for Museum and Library Services. We have collaborated with Jim Spadaccini at IDEUM and our friend Tom Scheinfeld. I wish Tom were on the podcast right now. To begin the development of something called Omeka Everywhere. And the idea with Omeka Everywhere is that based on the technology that the folks at IDEUM have developed, we're going to start to see Omeka used in in-gallery applications. That means touch screens, surface tables, those kinds of things, so that museums and science centers can start to build a central collection of materials and then purpose it in many ways. And I think that the thing that is going to be the most interesting for our gadget-friendly listeners, is the notion that we're going to bring Heist to Omeka. And the Heist interface from IBM means that users will be able to grab content out of an Omeka installation in a gallery and take it home with them using their phones. So we'll start to see Omeka installations increase user interaction in museum galleries and those sorts of things.
That's very cool.
Isn't it cool?
Yeah, that is cool. All around.
Yeah.
So now, because I always want more, will we be able to go the other way, grab some content with our phone and put it into our Omeka database?
Well, so the idea that there will be front-end Omeka applications and mobile applications suggests that perhaps that will include an update of the contribution material so that it's possible to add that way. We've been wanting to do that for a long time, and I think that increasingly as the Omeka interface gets more and more responsive and mobile friendly, that may be on the horizon. It's not specifically written into this proposal, but it seems like a good idea.
Well, so, whenever that happens, I want you to tell me who the developer was who figured out how to do that, because I will bring them an Easter basket full of goodies and probably give them a big hug, because that's the thing I want.
You know,
I always want more.
You're not the only one. Yeah. But I think that because there will actually be mobile applications that go along with this, that we'll figure out a little bit more easily how to do that. And because it builds on the existing version of Omeka with that nice shiny API, it should be easier than it ever has been before. But we have another turn of events.
Wait, there's more.
There's more. And this is from the library side of IMLS. They have given us the go-ahead to build, and this should make our academic users happy, some close and distant reading tools for Omeka. We have known for a long time that that all sorts of users want to annotate their Omeka items so that they can offer their users a close reading of the material that they're creating in Omeka. So that will include an image annotation plugin, which we had a long time ago and it has been deprecated since, I don't know, Omeka 0.09 or something like that. An image annotation plugin and a text annotation plugin. And on the other end, on the distant reading end, we're going to build an ngram plugin that will allow you to select a corpus of material and trace comparatively word frequencies through there, and a general word frequency plugin. So hopefully, once we get that stuff in place, we can start to think about things like co-location and those kinds of more sophisticated search and computation tools for Omeka.
And you're going to have that ready for next semester so I can use it in my class?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, both of these are three-year grants, so it's going to take us a little while to get them going. But the coding and planning magic of Jim Safley will be key to the creation of the distant reading plugin, so you can bug him about that yourself, Mills.
Okay, well, he'll probably be the one to get the Easter basket when it's all done then. So
There you go. So lots of new things.
Yeah, thanks. That's really exciting. And for our listeners who are Omeka users, this is all really exciting stuff. And they, I'm sure, are having the same reaction that I just did, which is, can I have that tomorrow? You know, I mean, it's just some coding. How long would it take? So, but no, it really is exciting stuff. And so thanks for that. And for those of you who aren't Omeka users, it's, you know, I'm not closely associated with the Omeka project, and so I keep dipping back into it to use it for various things that I do. And every time I go, it's new and more exciting. So thanks for working on that. I really appreciate it. Personally, I really appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate that you appreciate it. And of the listeners out there who would like to be release candidate testers, keep your eyes open, because as these plugins get developed and this functionality gets added, we're going to need a lot of response from users in the world to make sure that things function the way they should and that they're supported the way they should be.
Yeah. To put it another way, you too can help break Omeka.
That's right. Breaking Omeka is almost the most important part in the development cycle.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, Sharon. And thanks to everybody for your contributions on today's podcast. And thanks to our listeners for sticking with us. And, you know, we're always inviting comments on our digitalcampus.tv webpage. And so please let us know what you think. So thanks and have a great week, everybody.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.